Hey everybody, this is Carlos Azalor, and you're watching Dan Ken's channel, Thorin, my man. Enjoy.
Right, this is going to be another episode of Daring Minds. I still haven't thought up a line. Sorry, I haven't got an opening line or a second angle. It's just the show where I try to get Gio hired unsuccessfully thus far. There you go, to be honest, just keep, you know, keep it 100. That's the,
you know. Right.
It's all right, well, success isn't, you know, about the destination, it's about the journey. So it's maybe exactly. Maybe in the end getting
I'm
hired
so
was the friends we made all the way along.
Duncan.
I know, exactly, there you go. It's all good. So our guest for this episode is going to be Paper Thin, and he is someone who you might have seen, well, first of all, he does the VCT events themselves, but also you might know him from the VCT Korea region. So he's doing, if you remember, we had a past episode with Achilleos, who I know from League of Legends and other games, but this is another person who's doing VCT. Now, the reason I thought this would be an interesting angle is because obviously VCT Masters is coming up. So if you've ever seen the past episodes of Daring Minds, understand when I say at the beginning, like, we'll use that and we'll do like a preview of the teams. I at all times hold the veto right of Thorin, which means I can at any moment just betray that line. And we might talk about one team and then just go around 15 side tangents of like what utility's like in Counter-Strike and what they do in Korea culturally and how they practice. We might go down all these rabbit holes and maybe we never even get back and talk about any of the other teams you're all waiting for us to get to. Or maybe we talk about them all. We'll see. Because obviously, Paper Thin, the angle that is this, right? When I'd got the Achilleos one on, that was actually mainly sort of like what I was alluding to there. It was mainly just to have an excuse to talk about cool things that generally people in Valorant might not know about Koreans. Like, they might not know about League of Legends angle and the history of the game and like the way they practice and the mentality and the coaching staff and all these interesting sort of weird little details and peccadilloes and idiosyncrasies. But now, actually, after the last VCT, dude, I think for real, like, we actually have to have a combo that I want to start the episode with of, is the RX, who are the best Korean team, are they actually a contender to win the event? Because with how wide open the last Masters event was, they were also a team that people think's like a promising team. I notice people often rave about some of the strategies. Where is the DRX team at? Because normally, like on the last one, Achilleos did what you have to do and sort of be like, yeah, I think if everything went well, they could do it, blah, blah, blah. Now it seems a little bit more legit, though. People all of a sudden don't look down on the minor regions, right, Paper Thin?
Yeah, I mean, especially with the way that, you know, Zeta and Paper Rex also played, like kind of the Asia APAC region as a whole is starting to gain a lot of steam, gain a lot of respect. And I think for DRX, like, this is the best version of them I've ever seen. And I've casted just about every game DRX has played, at least since First Strike, you know, or at least watched it very closely and been a part of it. So what's really kind of changing DRX right now is part of what made DRX so good, right, when they won like 100 and whatever, three or two games it was in a row, was that they were setting their own meta, right? They were setting their own pace. Everybody was trying to learn from them because of the way they would combo utility, right? The flash and dash, that was DRX or Vigil Strikers at the time. And they were the ones who kind of pioneered some of these utility combos. So now you add Fade to the game. And this is an agent that falls right into DRX's wheelhouse. They love to combo the utility. Like, you'll see stuff like, you know, you can Prowler, Flash, and then follow up with the Jet or the Neon or whatever. Like, a lot of times they'll use the Fade utility to set up RB on the Neon, which is another kind of interesting change they made. So what I like about DRX is they're not trying to mimic anybody else's meta. They're trying to set their own.
Okay.
Interesting. I don't think...
Was I overhyping it there? Was I gassing up the region angle there, Gio?
I don't think that they are a title contender for this event, but that's not a comment on DRX not being a good team. It's a comment on other teams being too good. I think that, for me, I would have to say the favorite is Fnatic, but I think that the biggest threat to that is probably PaperX. And I think that right now, it's very hard to look at any team that is outside of the sort of EMEA NA bubble and point at any team that isn't PaperX as sort of the best potential upsetter. I mean, and even then, like, Loud could be one that come in. They obviously got to the finals in the last event as well. Although I can't say I've watched the Brazilian region, so I don't know if their sort of form has continued in just as good a shape. I will be very interested to see how DRX play, because I do think one of the points the Paper Thin made there is a really interesting one, which is that when you are being a meta setter, for lack of a better term, you have a much higher opportunity to succeed, I think. And It was really interesting, actually, because I saw Yinsu. She did an interview with Aaron from Exet, so we're talking about NA here, on her YouTube channel. And one of the points that he brought up is he felt that while the meta between EU and NA is quite similar right now, a lot of teams are playing really differently compared to other eras of Valorant that we've had in the past, where a lot of teams will play a lot more similarly. So I do think those differences in being able to play off of your own strengths are probably going to be more influential in this event because of that sort of separation in how people are playing. I just think that teams like PaperX are going to be way, way too powerful to really give DRX a very viable look into the finals.
Well, it's kind of funny because so DRX, one of their biggest scrim partners is PaperX. Like DRX and PaperX go way back in terms of playing each other and these kind of things. And it, as good as PaperX is, they're really, really good. And I don't want to take anything away from them. DRX has their number, right? They beat them every time that they face them at an international. From what I understand, they routinely beat them. But the weird thing is I would actually kind of agree with you that I think PaperX has more deep run potential than DRX unless they run into DRX. Like DRX seems to just have certain teams' numbers. And this has happened in Korea. This has now happened a little bit internationally with PaperX, where they run into them in the group stages and they can't beat them. So I really like PaperX, and I don't want to take anything away from them at all because I think they're absolutely insane. Jing and Forsaken are just absolute nutters. But you're absolutely right as well that the meta in Asia is wildly different than that of NA and EU, particularly attacker-sided, right? Like, Asian teams are very much better at the attacker side, or at least they focus on that as kind of their bread and butter, as where they look to really get their damage done.
I think also just kind of like springboard off of that point that you just made about how things have gone in the group stages is that PaperX, of course, are not starting in the group stage. So in order for them to face up against each other, DRX need to qualify into the playoffs. But because they're in Group B, which I think is, most people probably agree, likely to be the easier group of the two, I think they are all but guaranteed to get into the playoffs. It just depends on where that seeding is going to be ultimately.
Especially, obviously, if indeed they end up having the problems with FPX, like if they can't get some of their players in and they end up having to take subs again. It could be a Fnatic scenario from last Masters, if people remember. So that would open the door to make it through. But here's the question then, Paper Thin, right? As you say, these are two teams that directly, Rex and DRX, can directly practice each other within the region. I wonder, like, stylistically, how do they match up then? Because obviously, normally the Western teams find it like, basically, like, I think that, like, PaperX is the most scary team, it seems like, because the playing styles are so aggressive, right? How do the Koreans normally match up with that? Do they have a handle on it?
Yeah, they generally, for the most part, seem to have a pretty good read on it these days. I mean, they kind of know what to expect with some of these, you know, really aggressive pushes down the long angles on various maps. Like, you know, everybody remembers back at Masters 1 with the way that they would push A main, pressure that. And I think DRX pretty well has an understanding of when and why that's going to happen. But at the same time, DRX has struggled against teams that play like that from time to time. Reyna's have given DRX fits. You see this all the time at different events where, you know, they're kind of, if they get thrown off their game plan, if they don't have like the mental protocols in place to kind of deal with the situation, all of a sudden they start to fall apart. But if they're prepared for you, if they know what to expect from you, if they're ready for it, they're a well-oiled machine and they seem to handle it very well. So, yeah, I mean, they know PaperX's tendencies very well just because they know each other so well. And they have a lot of respect for PaperX as well in terms of the way they play, in terms of the caliber of players they have. But so far, it's gone DRX's way. But we'll see if that changes. I mean, this could be, you know, I think PaperX is a team that if they catch fire, just like Zeta did at the previous tournament, they could run teams over.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting you say that, because actually I would say, painting with very broad strokes, obviously, because I'm literally generalizing, Korean teams and players in a lot of esports games I've followed, the way that they seem to learn and practice games is what you would call iterative. Like, they just get a blueprint and then they repeat it and they try to basically refine all the small details. And essentially, a lot of the approach seems to be like a flowchart approach. Like, if A, then C, D, you know, and you pick the options and you try to always follow the sort of the correct path, like the highest efficiency chance to succeed in the game. So I will say, if from watching lots of different esports games, that does actually seem to be the best chance you have against like the best Koreans. Because obviously in some games, Koreans are the absolute pinnacle of the best region or country or whatever. Basically, if you can get into scenarios where you play like a brawl style or some sort of chaotic style where you just increase the variance. And at that point in time, the key thing is this, you know that there isn't a perfect, you're not even trying to think like, what would the perfect move? You're just doing what you do. You react, you play off each other, etc. But if in their scenario they're so used to always, like, as you say, having a protocol list that they always follow in this particular way, you can throw them off a bit, you can make them a bit uncomfortable. They definitely prefer it when, like, put it this way, Korea is the ultimate region in esports that loves that old saying of, like, you know, the greatest swordsman in the world isn't scared of the second best swordsman, he's scared of the man who's never held a sword, because, you know, you might do like a random move that you don't. Korea are the ones who want to play the second best swordsman all the time. They want to play like, this is proper like Valorant, and we play like A meets B, follows C, follows D. I'm sure that's why, for example, famously within their region, it's often like the right team beats the right team all the time. It's like the correct, you have the favorites winning the right, because like the underdog plays the right way to lose, but play correct Valorant. So that's why actually these are the regions that you want to look at for like the like throw them off their game in this regard. Maybe NA as well, just have style. Because basically back in Counter-Strike, we had some Korean teams that got very good in the old version of Counter-Strike, but that was the one area, Paperthin, I noticed they would always fall apart. They would be good at the opening parts of the round or the basic, like, everyday sort of style of, like, you know, how roughly how attackers are going to play and defensive are going to play.
Right.
But the problem they would have was European teams were at the best when the round breaks. Like, it becomes like a 2v2 and you're just playing off each other. And at that point, it's nothing to do with anything you know, planned in a scrim or in spawn. Like, you know, you're just playing off each other reactively. That was where they would get thrown, because in that moment, they couldn't suddenly, like, sort of read what the other person was doing as well, because they weren't in our region. So they weren't practicing against those players. They didn't know them as well. So that as an angle, obviously, again, very broad strokes. But I would say that is something to watch in the game. It's why I'm not surprised, by the way, like as you said earlier, I'm not surprised they came up with loads of tactical innovations and things that when you really perfect like this move, it just works mega well. That's sort of the Korean way of practicing and improving, as far as I can tell.
Well, and it's so funny you talk about, real quick, the previous like CSGO experience, is because, right, like all the coaching staff for DRX are previous CSGO players, sure, right? The We Made Fox players, right? Termi, Glow are both on that staff. And so, like, you nailed it, dude. Like, they play exactly like you're talking about. They don't know how to deal with mid-round adaptation sometimes. Like, Reyna, I would say disruptive play causes DRX right. issues. Or and so, like, M3C, right, at last year's Masters 3 in Berlin, was such a problem for them because of the way, like, Nats plays. He's so unpredictable. Reyna's caused them problem because of dismisses. So, like, the protocol in place where they try to follow up on a kill or follow up on a trade get thrown out the window because the Reynas are able to get out of those situations where they're not able to quickly trade off of it like they would like to. So I really like what you're saying. I really think you hit the nail on the head.
It's interesting as well, because it makes it kind of exciting to see how DRX will face up against FPX in the group stages, because FPX are a team that really like to change things up very frequently. And so I think that that's the sort of play style and that's the sort of team that can really test and push the limits of the preparedness of DRX, right? It's like, skill wise, I think they will absolutely have the skill to make that a really worthwhile game. But in terms of like having done the drills specifically, because it's not like FPX are the sort of team who you can look at them and say, okay, they played this way in this game. This is their usual comp for this. Like, we're going to practice that, because that's not really how FPX work as a team. And so I think that even in the group stage, we could end up seeing like how much DRX are ready for that and their kind of tenacity in that sort of situation before we even reach the playoffs, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say, I think actually, because we had Ardis as a guest on this show way back at the beginning, I think he even said something along the lines of, like, they have times in the game where, like, he can just do whatever he wants, basically. Like,
yeah.
Like in that scenario, how are you supposed to read what he's going to do? He doesn't know himself. He's about to figure it out, isn't he? You
know? Well, and it's tough for DRX, because if they don't... if they don't know what to expect, if they're not prepared, like this is why Paper Rex doesn't scare me as much as some other teams, just because they played each other so much. Like they understand the tendencies and kind of like what Paper Rex is thinking on paper, Paper Rex, like, is scary to DRX. It is the antithesis to their play style. But again, they played each other a lot. But FPX scares the crap out of me. And all the EU teams scare the crap out of me because they're so good at mid-round adaptations, like you're talking about. Sometimes they just straight up don't have a plan. And if DRX isn't mentally prepared for that, they do struggle. Now, I will say one cool thing about this particular stage for DRX in the Korea region is that Termi, as a coach, has really adjusted his coaching style to a much less rigid style. He is now opening up the players to kind of let them do what they want when they want. He was taking very few timeouts. I mean, part of that is a consequence of them just at times dominating the other teams, but also he didn't want to cut in and kind of give his opinion. He wanted to make his team figure it out themselves. He wanted, you know, Zest as the IGL to really figure these things out, figure out the mid-round adaptations, and learn how to adapt on the fly better.
Okay. By the way, if we just pivot a bit, Gio, is Paper X a contender? Are they a dark horse? Yes. Where would you put them? Like, are they a team that could... Is there a world where they fuck around and just win VCT?
I could see them winning. As I said at the beginning, I personally think the Fnatic are probably the best chance of winning, but I could see Paper X winning. From everything that I have seen, they have become more consistent over the course of the last stage. And also, they just incite so much fear in their opponents. And I think that because their play style is so antithetical to what a lot of these teams are used to, that's going to be like the real question. And I think that teams are going to have to be they're going to have to play in a way that is specifically catered around catching out Paper Rex. I think rather than like rushing in and trying to beat them at their own game, which obviously puts you in a position as a team where you're kind of playing around your opponent's play style, which generally isn't the encouraged way to play. You typically want to be like, all right, we'll play to our play style and just outdo them. But if you allow Jing and Forsaken to just kind of do what they usually do, I don't think you're going to get very far into a round. Like, you're going to be losing opening duels, you're going to be having your economy destroyed. And so they do teams that are going to succeed against Paper X are going to have to be ones that potentially play a little bit more passively, but really like kind of sly and like cleverly. So, you know, while I obviously think the teams are going to be preparing for that because, they are an opponent in this competition, but also I think there will probably be a lot of teams who do see Paper X as a real threat. I'm curious to see actually how many will succeed in that sense. But I do definitely think that they are a potential contender.
Okay. I mean, paper thin. After the last Masters, obviously, there was a point where they were looking super dangerous in the tournament. They helped eliminate some of the big teams. Do you think they actually have, like, where would you put them in your hierarchy of teams that could win this event?
I think Paper Rex is probably my fourth or fifth place team in a team that could win this. I think there's no doubt they can do it. I'm going to put, like, Fnatic Optic above them. I'm not so sure about Xset, for example. I don't know what to expect out of Crew. I think DRX is slightly better than them, and the only reason I say that is because if they run into DRX, DRX just seems to have their number, but that could change, right? Like, Paper Rex, you know, they're lightning in a bottle, man. Once it's unleashed, they're really hard to stop. They're really hard to deal with because they just start feeling the flow of the game, and they're really tough to shut down, even if you know it's coming. Like, teams would know it's coming, and they still couldn't stop it, right? And so it's all about... You know, Paper Rex to me is kind of just a streaky team. If they get hot, yeah, they can shut anyone down. They can beat anybody in this tournament. But sometimes, you know, they haven't shown me that they can consistently do that yet.
Because the interesting thing to me is anytime I ever hear that, like, one team plays, like, super aggressive in a way that the other teams don't, etc., like, normally that just spells out, like, good for an upset every now and then. Like, you're not going to win long-term. But I have to say, one of the reasons why, though, is because if that happens in Counter-Strike, because we have a circuit where everyone just plays so often, the point is you'll get figured out. Like, if that is, like, a too gimmicky style, all the best teams and in-game leaders and coaches spend the next 2 months just looking at your team, figuring out how not to get upset by you again, and then they get that sort of, they adapt to what you do. But I'll say the interesting angle here, obviously, is Paper X gets to like terrorize the teams at the Masters and then go away to another region, and then no one has any contact with them from NA or EU, and no one is practicing against them. So here's the problem: when that type of style, like you say, it's not just like they're just doing a different approach, they're also doing a style that's really annoying to play against. When you have an approach like that, you want to actually get your reps in the server. You want to be like comfortable playing it from in the server, not just watching a VOD or something and going like, what would we do against that? I guess that we try and sort of hypothetical, like it's shadow box like that's way harder than people realize. It's like, so I actually think that could be like a dark horse angle for the Paper X team, though. It's like you say, if they just come in and the players individually are in good form, if there might be teams who think they can deal with that style, but they might find out they can't in the actual game. Yeah,
exactly. I can see it.
It's just crazy what Forsaken and Jhin can do, and also the fact that with those two, they can sort of, because they can kind of cover all of the different duelists and stuff, and they're happy to flex between those. Like, there's a lot of flexibility in that specific, like, role right. within the team. And the fact that, you know, so much of their, like, aggression and success comes from those two, being able to have flexibility between them as well means that there isn't necessarily like one steadfast weakness in that either, right? Because if it's like a team always rely on, I let's use this as a slightly adjacent example. At some points in stage one this year, at least, it sort of became apparent that within Optic, if you could kill Ye early in a round, you would have a significant advantage in bringing down the rest of the team, because like Ye on Chamber is just such a major part of the way that they play. Whereas like if you get rid of one out of Forsaken and Jhin in Paper X, it's not like that's sort of like closing off one whole role or aim or objective within the team itself. Like that can be picked up by right. the other one within the team. Obviously, like a 4v5 is never going to be advantageous, yeah, but like in Optic, there isn't another person who's going to be able to like fill in what it was that Ye was doing, because that's the Ye job. But there is a lot more overlap between Forsaken and Jhin, and I think that's quite scary when you're looking at front lines.
Sure. Yeah,
I fully agree. I mean, those two are so well respected in the Asia region. I mean, the DRX players will stream, you know, duos with them, you know, whether it be RB or Stax or whoever, because they respect them so much. They want to play with these guys because they're so good. They want to see what they're doing. They want to learn from this aggressive style. Like, you know, what kind of maneuvers are they making? What kind of timings are they using? You know, how do they use their utility to bait opponents so they can get the the advantage in the dual trade and things like that? So, I fully agree with her. And I think the thing that Paper X just needs to work on, in my opinion, if they're going to be a real force to be reckoned with, is just post-plant, just kind of teamwork. I know the one thing that to me breaks apart for Paper Rex is when they plant or the other, you know, if they're on the defender side, the other team plants, they tend to just kind of try to continue to take those 1v1 duels right. and rely on that, you know, expert ability that they have to win those. But that, you know, in a staggered defense scenario like that, like if you're playing against, you know, attackers who have a good setup post plant with their crossfires and things like that, that tends to break down.
Sure. Yeah, I will also say as well, that's like another flaw. It's like, obviously, when you're in like post-plant scenarios, you don't want to take duels if not unnecessary. That's even a point, by the way, if people don't know. And this is one of the areas it makes me sound like I'm being condescending, but pro players, remember, some pro players are just a 19-year-old kid that has amazing aim and only became a pro like 1 year ago, 2 years ago. They're not all like masters of the game who know every aspect and do everything perfectly correctly, technique-wise and game theory-wise. So one area that even in CSGO, top pros will fuck up in is exactly that. Like sometimes amazing aim just take the aim duel every time, whereas like the joke is, if you're like the in-game leader or some like less skilled player, you're like, we had the bomb down, like you could have just tooled this guy, you could have made him run around the box half the time, you could have made him like force him to come to a certain spot and like killed it. Like essentially, if you're someone who doesn't have like godlike aim, you're like, why are you using aim to win the round? Like, you could win the round in a different way. So that's one area I can understand why people who win the round elsewhere through aggression are going to think, yeah, you just win the fight, don't you? But that's not as consistent a way to win in tactical FPS, I'll tell you that. What about this then? So, Gio, you said you have Fnatic as the best team, right? The cool thing about the Fnatic story is This almost looks like narratively they've put, it's like this is a fucking TV series, like when you did that skit video on your YouTube where it was like cast like a reality series.
Because
think about it. There you go. Because think about it. On the last one, right, Fnatic came in, people were excited, but then they had that crap where they had to bring all the stand-ins. It was like, it just sucked all the energy out. Now they're coming, they've got new players, but actually the new players they've picked up are some like lightning in a bottle. Like, where the fuck have they found these guys? And suddenly, if anything, the team looks mega now. So is this team going to win the event? Are they actually going to make good on the promise?
I could see it happening. So obviously the new player, well, the two new players that you talk about are Enzo and Afaya, but Afaya is really the one that has kind of blown everybody away. The big question regarding this event is that, you know, being in this sort of like LAN environment, is that going to be the same? It's sort of like as you ask with any kind of
right.
player, right? Especially if they get to, you know, the
oh, because he's 17 years old, right? This Alpha guy,
he's a kid, yeah. Like, you know, and if they get to the later stages of the playoffs, that's going to be in front of a crowd. So it's not even just like all of the LANs that have currently happened, where you're just like, okay, I'm on a PC in a room with a lot of other people. It's like there's a lot of people actually cheering you on. Now, I would love to see this guy be really like driven by that crowd. I think he'd be one of the most entertaining players in the entire game if that happened, because it's just so easy to kind of get behind him and cheer for him. I think that they have just been really impressive this stage. I think that Durka has obviously just been having a really good year so far. And actually, I think it was Josh on Plat Chat put it, he said this is Durka's opportunity to prove that he is the best player in the world, right? And so there's just, and I just think like Boaster obviously is that IGL, like is such a well-equipped IGL to be guiding this team through this event. And I just think that their performance within EMEA this stage has been nothing short of exceptional. And while I think that FPX have obviously also been incredibly impressive as well, assuming that they have all of their players there, they have still had like some turmoil and whatnot. And I can just, I don't know, I can see FPX like doing extremely well as well, but I could also see them falling off. And I don't think Guild are going to be as much of a challenge as Fnatic. And crucially, I don't think Optic are as well. As much as it kills me to say that, because I love Optic Gaming, I just think that Fnatic have looked sublime in this stage in a way that I haven't really seen from these other major teams, particularly in EMEA and NA.
Okay. Are you riding with, are you going to wax lyrical like that paper thin? I feel like the best.
I loved it. Actually, I agree with her fully that I think Fnatic is probably the best team at this event. To me, I really liked what she was talking about. I think, you know, Alfair, is that how you pronounce it? Alfair? Is that right?
Yeah, it's like Alfire.
Alfire? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's amazing. I mean, just, and she makes a great point. We don't know what to expect with him. I think Durk is the best player in the world, and I think he'll prove it at this event. I truly believe this. This guy is just absolute ice in his veins. He can do everything. He's so versatile as a player that doesn't seem like he makes too many mistakes. He has bad games every now and then, but who doesn't? And I think Boaster in particular has really impressed me. Like, I've spent a lot of time watching Boaster's streams because he does a really interesting job of watching other teams and looking for little set plays, little set pieces that he can use at the beginning of rounds. And then he'll talk about, you know, how to follow up of that, how he wants to do, like, you know, post plants and all these things. And he really impressed me with kind of the work ethic he has and the sort of desire for diversity. He wants to find all kinds of different strats from anywhere he can find them, new lineups, whatever. You know, I remember watching him. He was watching Zeta's stream for, you know, Sova lineups that he didn't know about. He learned like a couple new Sova lineups and things like that. So to me right now, I think Fnatic's the best team in the world. I think they're probably going to win this event if everything goes kind of according to plan. And I think Optic has a real shot still. I think Loud could get it done still. I really like Loud as well. I'd actually rate Loud higher than DRX or Paper Rex right now as well. I think they're slightly better. But yeah, I'd have to go with Fnatic if you put a gun to my head and asked me to pick a team.
Okay. By the way, on that point that Gio was making about our fire, since he's a 17-year-old kid and he's inexperienced, he's not only young, he's also inexperienced, which are the two things that obviously kill you when you go to LAN. Right, I will say on that whole topic, the problem with that whole angle, in CSGO especially, this was a massive topic the last 2 years, because when we had the whole online period, it lasted so long that you had teams rise and fall, so you had like underdogs rise up, and whereas if it was LAN, they would have slowly risen up, like, you know, you get like some group stage upsets, but then you fall in like the quarters, you get used to playing on stage, eventually, you know, like 6 months later, you're in the final, you're a good team. Instead, what would happen is, because it was online play, teams that like were up underdogs actually just rose straight to the top of the game. Some of them were even ranked number one in the world because it was online play. But then when we came to LAN, some of them have never won a LAN tournament, even in all the months we've had since, and loads of chances, because it's just a different environment. So the problem goes like this: even like Gio said, even the LANs that don't have the crowd, you're still getting used to all the things of like travel to another country, go to a different event, be in a stadium and or studio rather, instead of your bedroom, set up your PC. By the way, that's a detail a fan at home never understands. Like, the PC will never feel 100% like the one at home in your bedroom. That's why these are the best players in the world, because you don't even remember that when they're doing the best moments you've ever seen on the screen. Like, these guys are so sick, essentially, they can do your best ever round, but just on your friend's PC. Like, you wouldn't be able to do that. Like, you'd be all complaining, like, oh, my mouse is off. Like, they can just do that, yeah.
I don't think people, like, give enough credit for how, like, ask the audio is. And the only reason that I know that is because at Masters Berlin, before like the event actually started, all of the talent got to play like basically it wasn't quite a tournament, but we got to play like a game on the stage because we were basically tech testing.
Right.
Which was pretty fun to say that I was part of the first team that won on the Masters Berlin stage. But as you say, it's uncomfortable because it's like, this isn't the same as my like setup at home, but the audio, and we didn't even have like all the noise going on around us, right? But it's still just not like super fun. Actually, for that event, they didn't have like the white noise with the in-ears. Right. They started bringing that in after that event. But that obviously is going to start shielding some of the sound that you hear in your in-ears, because you've got to block out everything that's going on around you. And then you've got like, you know, five other people potentially yelling, four other people potentially yelling down the microphone as well, right? So like the sort of nice, like almost in vitro environment that you have at home is very different to what it's like there.
Like, for example, I mean, someone mentioned it on a past episode, but one thing happens every now and then, you might just miss a footstep. If you're at home, you might have perfect sound, you might be able to hear everything, and you might not in this game, so you think that spot's clear in a pro match, and the guy's behind you. Like, imagine that. That's a real thing you have to deal with. But then the other thing for me is this. That's just like, you've got to put in your reps. You've got to go to the event. You've got to get the setup. Yeah, we all get that. You get over that part. The problem is the stadium angle, because the problem with the events in the modern day of esports is you don't tend to play in front of the crowd on day one in the group. Like, so they've even made that become sort of like a threshold. It's not just, are you good enough to get out of the group? It's like, if you get out of the group, if your team has no experience in front of crowds, do you just cry? Because by the way, that happens. Like, that's why I was giving the CSGO analogy. There was actually a team that in the online period was the number one team in the world. And if you watched with the eye test, they played the best Counter-Strike, because they had no LAN experience. They couldn't win the major. The major's like fucking an enormous crowd. You know, there's millions of people watching at home. Like, that'll get to you. Because what I'm saying in this case is, right, this guy's got a chance because he's one individual. It only has to be one person has to not get affected by that. So you can get lucky like that. That can happen, right? If you have a whole team of five, you're probably in fucking... Listen, you're hoping for a miracle there that five people are not going to get affected by it. So listen, there might be a scenario, because this happens every now and then, where he has no issues whatsoever. He's just amazing. Sometimes I would say, basically, my joke would be, it's like the Roadrunner phenomenon. Obviously, in the cartoon Roadrunner, it's only when you look down that you fall, isn't it? The first part where you run off the cliff, you're fine because you don't know you're off a cliff. That can happen sometimes. You can sort of sometimes look into it. This actually happened this year in Counter-Strike. We had a 16-year-old Russian kid who was some like phenom, and he'd never played at the top in big lands, and he got signed to G2, and they just brought him, and his first LAN was one of the biggest LANs we have in Counter-Strike. But amazingly, he was one of those people who just sort of like hit the ground running. Like, he didn't actually fail his first time. So my joke would be like, because he didn't fall the first time, he doesn't even know you fall when you run off the cliff. He's fine right now. But by the way, everyone falls at one point, so he's gonna have to find that out later down the line. So that it's more like, I would say the general approach when someone's got no no LAN experience, and especially if they're young, is you should probably be skeptical that they'll be as good as they were online. That's just a default position. And then if they're the rare person that breaks through and they're amazing just from day one, fair play. Maybe there's some prodigy or there's some guy with this super unique mindset that doesn't get rattled like that. But I would say as a general rule, and the other reason, by the way, well, we're not even being harsh by saying be a bit skeptical. Spoiler, even just the normal best players in the world don't then play as well in the playoffs and like online in front of a stadium. Like everyone gets a little bit worse. There's another reason, by the way, why these players in esports are the absolute best in the world. And it doesn't matter that, like, you could do that move in a random POG game. They're doing it in the World Championship final on stage in front of millions of people, while in their brain, some of their brains even go, don't fuck this up, it's your whole career. Like, that's where they're styling, doing like the best moves ever. So it's a different game, boys and girls. Right, what about this then? So aside from Fnatic, the other, you've raised it there. We've got a bit of a split here. So Geo, why all of a sudden are you become Judas Geo? You're just turning on Optic right before they have a chance.
Judas?
What the hell? Surely you're supposed to say they're going to go back to back. They're your team, Optic.
I'm not that far gone. Okay. I'm just skeptical because,
all right.
A, we have to remember Optic did not win NA this stage. True. They came second, right? So we've already had Optic sort of like falling. And I need to add the asterisk at yes, there was COVID involved, right? And you don't know how much of an impact that's had, right? But there has still been this sort of like slight trip before we've even like got to the event, which I think is just something that you have to kind of consider. And yeah, they actually didn't come first in NA last time either. So maybe it just doesn't matter at all. But I just feel like when I look at teams like Fnatic and the way I just spoke about them with such reverence, and even Paper Rex, is like, even though they are playing in very different ways to each other, both of those teams feel like they are playing the absolute best way that you can approach that playstyle right now. Whereas Optic, I don't know if I feel the same about right now. Like, I just did this like video on YouTube last week, and one of the things I was talking about is the fact that Optic have continued to see success where Sentinels haven't, because Optic have always kind of kept this air of like ingenuity and innovation to remain ahead of the meta. And I'm not sure that's true right now, because they're still relying on, for example, these like Neon comps, which are what they brought in and really popularized towards the end of stage one. And I'm just not convinced that that's still the best way to play, or like the most optimal way to play, or really the way that's going to not be able to be outdone by the best international teams. They may be good enough at it to make up for it in their own region, but when you're coming together with the best teams from every other meta and every other playstyle in the world right now, and you've been playing this playstyle, you know, for the last few months, and people know, not only do people know how you do it, but they can also see where the flaws are. Like, one of the biggest flaws of the Neon comp when they first played it against version one was that it was amazing on attack and arse on defense, right? That still remains true. It's still true. So like, these flaws have been kind of broadcast to the world, and unless Optic like bring out something new, I just can't confidently say that they are going to be able to keep that stuff on top of everybody else right now. I still think that they are going to get very far in this competition. I don't see them dropping out in groups. I don't see them dropping out in early in the playoffs. Like, I can still see them making it to top three or whatever, but do I think they're gonna win the competition? If they did, I'd be like, okay, cool. I'm not overly surprised. But if they didn't, I certainly wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. Come on then, Paper Thin. What's your take, mate?
I mean, what surprised me about Optic, and I think what's funny to me is I think Optic's win at Masters 1 was almost more mental than anything. And they have one of those kind of rare abilities to take negative feedback, to take negative press, and turn it into wins. Sort of, I swear to God, they watched that Michael Jordan. Yeah, like Chet, right? Chet said kind of some, you know, I don't think they were horrible things after a match that when they lost to Xersha. I think he just kind of didn't speak as eloquently as he would have liked, right? And I think, like, all that bad press, all that negative attention, they took that and they fed on that. It's kind of like Michael Jordan used to do. You know, he'd take that bad press, he'd take that bad feedback, and he'd use that to fuel himself to be better. And I think for Optic, like, I saw this even after they won, Masters won. Like, I remember seeing an article, like, or a tweet saying that everybody's doubting on us, all this other stuff. I'm like, you just won Masters. What are you talking about? And I think they at least kind of, like, realize that they can feed off of that same kind of energy. Yes. And that can actually, that is such a huge effect in these kind of situations. And I mean, every professional athlete will tell you that like some of the best feed off of negative attention like that to fuel that anger inside of them that focuses them like a laser.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's even a logic to it if you think psychologically, because basically the premise goes like this. It's actually the premise, if people don't understand of what you, if you can't get this mentality in your head, don't ever try combat sports because you're going to be wrecked. Basically, the reason why in combat sports, like if it's you or me and we're just a pleb watching, of course, the first thing you think is like, fuck, that looks painful getting hit. That's the whole premise. They don't think about that. They're willing to take the punch to give a punch, right? So like the problem is like, unless you can do that, like it's really fucking dangerous. So in this scenario, yeah, exactly. You have to have that mentality. You have to basically be willing to fucking just ignore the damage that's being done to you. That's not as easy mentally, but I got the same vibe, because what's funny is even though they themselves with the initial check comments got embroiled in like drama that they were like probably a bit annoyed by, they themselves do it. If you ever look at interviews, they're always the ones who were like cheesed at, like, oh, some analysts said this about us, or can you believe bloody fans don't rate us in this way? That, like, that can sound petty, but I agree, paper thin. Like, what they're doing is trying to find new reasons to keep themselves motivated, because in theory you could go the other way, right? You could be like, well, we just won, we're number one, like, you know, rest on our laurels, like, let's see until someone takes it from us or something. Like, that's, I like that angle though. Like, they're trying to keep themselves engaged with it and give themselves some other bullshit reason to do it. It's true.
I think Optic as well, like, the win that they got in Reykjavik was sort of like, you know, they crossed the line on a hubcap, right? Like the last two of the three games they played, or maps that they played, were in overtime, right? So it was like they fought for that victory. 3-0 makes it look like it was a blowout. It was not a blowout. It really wasn't. And so I don't think that necessarily says anything bad about them. I think it's really impressive, and it actually, you know, sort of corroborates the argument of the two of you about like it being a very much a mental thing. And I think Optic are good at that, because they wouldn't have been able to remain consistent with their results, you know, barring Champs as a sort of exception there, over the last best part of a year, if not. But it just does make me wonder when you look at, I mean, their opponent from that finals was Loud. Loud in Brazil haven't dropped a single map in this stage, right? So it's like, they've gone away and Optic have still come out of their domestic season or domestic stage succeeding and doing really well. But like the people they were playing against, it almost feels like the jump they've made from last event to this event has been more substantial. And I think that's where a lot of kind of my fear comes in. Now, whether that is, you know, did they need to make that more substantial jump to meet Optic's level, and Optic were already up here and they only needed to be consistent and make a tiny jump? Like, maybe that is the case, or maybe it is that those teams have now superseded where Optic is, and that's what I'm sort of kind of waiting to find out. I do think Optic will make it out of the group stage, even though they are in the arguably hardest group. I think that Optic and Loud are probably going to be the two teams to make it out of Group A, so I do see them getting to playoffs, but I think that they are really going to be pushed in this event.
Another team I would like to talk about, I mean, not least because they won their region. They're a team that, if Optic's legit, this team should be good as well. It's Exet, obviously. The team that, like, a few episodes I talked about this, because they always were, like, promising in the VCT. Like, they had to eventually get to one of these bloody Masters or something. Otherwise, it'd just be a waste of talent, wouldn't it? The problem is, I already saw, this is where you can sort of see where people are trying to get ahead of the potential problems, Gio. I already saw that in, like, an interview, Def or someone had said something like, you know, we have, like, past experience from, like, majors in CSGO. Like, one, Def does have experience. He was in, like, I think top 8 of one major ever in CSGO. That was considered an insane fluke run. And aside from that, he was basically, like, a player who went to the tier 1 lands and would go out at the beginning of the tournament, like, the first day or two. So if that's your most experienced player, I'm not really sure that experience counts. Like, essentially, he just went and lost in the big lands. And then the others, like, that doesn't work at all, whoever said that. The rest of this team is riddled with inexperience. Like, these are people who are nobodies. They haven't been in top teams in other games, as far as I can tell. So, like, that's that's the one angle I have a concern about here. If, as I alluded to, sometimes this team would sort of be like promising but never quite deliver on it in online play. Now we're coming to the LAN, and remember, they're going to skip straight to those playoffs. Like, they're going to be in that playoff bracket, and that's going to be, I mean, I think this is potentially what affected teams like the Guild. Like, think of the pressure when your first LAN match is like a big playoff game. Like, you don't even get a warm-up. You just come in and you better be good in match one. That's my concern for the exit team. What do you think?
It's an interesting one, because, yeah, I've also seen like similar discussion about like, oh, is there a risk that Exit are going to have a similar experience to the God? So, yeah, I just checked, like, while Def had that, his experience in Counter-Strike, BCJ was in Apex Legends and Aaron was in Crossfire of all games. So I knew that those two also have some kind of LAN experience. I don't know to what extent, but I just needed to check the games, and those
are
games,
sure.
You know. So yeah, I guess it's about how much stock you put in the experience of them. I mean, what, BCJ was on T1 for Apex Legends? I'm going to assume that T1 are a decent team because they're T1.
It must be, you think, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know, because Exet, like, the Guard kind of came out of nowhere, whereas Exet have been in the ecosystem for a little while. And I think as well, like, Cryo has been one of, I think, the most impressive Jets in NA for a little while, but also Zekin, this stage particularly, has really overachieved. And again, I don't necessarily want to put, like, too much lenience on the fact that, like, oh great, they have a wonderful front line, like they can play really aggressive, because I don't think that is enough. But I think the fact that they've had really good performance, obviously, like, is a good sign. I think also, like, with Aaron being, you know, he was always their Viper player, and in this stage he's had the opportunity to kind of flex out from that, and maybe having some more of that flexibility has given them more freedom, and they just feel a lot more comfortable in the way that they're playing the game. I'm not as concerned about them bombing out in a similar fashion to the way that the Guard did, because while you can discredit some of the experience on the team, I think that they're still, if you were to average it over, is more than there was on the Guard. Because with the Guard, it's mostly like you were leaning on Sire, yeah, sure, player, and being like, this guy was on the Overwatch League stage like every week, and everyone else is like just out of kindergarten, right? So I still do think that it's different, because there has been more consistency. It's sort of like how you look at Guild and it's like, okay, this is their first big event, but they've still been in that sort of top four range, sure, for quite a while. I think, again, like, Exet, I think, like, in a vacuum are really good. They obviously just won NA, but again, it's sort of that argument of, like, how does that fare up against these teams like Loud and Crew and PaperX, who, that is new for them. Like, that's not new for Optic, and I've already expressed some skepticism about Optic, right? But that is new for Exet, and I think that it's teams like that that are going to be the decider as to whether or not, like, a team like Exet goes particularly far. I think it's less about what they've achieved in NA or how they could fare against a team like Fnatic or FPX. Like, I think it's going to be more about how do they fare against these teams from the quote-unquote minor regions. And I don't know if I have, like, the faith as much in that. Because, again, we're sort of at that point in the life cycle of Valorant now, Valorant Esports, where you have some teams that have returned back to these major events. And so teams like Fnatic and teams like Optic and teams like DRX have played, like, Loud and Crew,
yeah,
and PaperX. Like, they are a known quantity. Like, they may be difficult. They may have a diametrically opposing playstyle. It may be a challenge, but they know them. They know what it's like to play against them. And you bring in these teams who have kind of finally risen to the top of their domestic league, and they've now got to be inaugurated into that experience. And I just don't know if I think that, like, they are going to be able to hold up against that.
What do you think, Pip?
I was Yeah, I was impressed with Xset's teamwork in the finals against Opstic. I was really amazed with how well they're playing off each other, how well, you know, they were comboing their utility. I mean, it reminded me a bit of like some of the better EU teams and that kind of thing in that match, but they have struggled previously. So again, I kind of agree with you, Gio, that I'm not exactly sure what to make of Xset right now. You never know. I think there's a lot of potential here, but you know, you can have all the, you know, teamwork and set plays in the world. And just like you see with DRX, I mean, you know, sometimes that just all just falls apart when you run into something you're not expecting or whatever. I mean, I guess I did find it, a little bit interesting that BCJ was running his mouth a little bit, talking about how, you know, he might be the best initiator in the world. I don't know if that's true. I mean, it's hard to classify initiators as well, just because there is kind of two different initiator roles, right? Like there's like a flasher sort of initiator, and then there's like information gathering initiators, and then there's KO is kind of like a cross between the two. So there is sort of it's kind of hard to judge that role because there's like, okay. I think Anders calls it like a flex initiator and something else, but it is going to be interesting to me. Like these players played very well in their run up, except for the first time they ran into Optic. And again, I don't know how much of Optic just being off their game or somebody was, like you said earlier, sick. Ye did not look good at all, and that's a huge kind of concern, I suppose, for Optic. Like he was just absolutely getting destroyed in his duels, and was not really participating with the team. A lot of times you can rely on Ye to just sort of win a lot of trades that he shouldn't for you, and he wasn't as consistent against Xset. I'm worried that they are going to be the guard, though. I mean, I know you said you don't think they will be, but I'm really worried about it. I mean, and like you said, they're going to be cold going into the playoffs. This is a wild card team for me, just like Leviathan, from Latin America. I have no idea how these guys are going to perform coming out.
One thing that you said there that I'd like to pivot onto and make a segue is like the idea that the BCJ guy's trying to talk like he's amazing, etc. That's the one question I had about Xset. Here's the difference. If Optic wins the LAN again, people are going to say, Ye's the MVP. He is the best player in the world. If Fnatic wins, yes, Durka probably will get finally the status of like, I'm the best player in the world, right? If Xset wins, who is the player who's actually like truly world-class? Who's the person who could be the best? Is it BCJ? Is he the best player on the team? Who would you guys say? Who should be their star figure name itself? Because obviously what I'm kind of making the point of is they don't have a traditional
Zekin?
Name that's like an enormous name,
Zekin.
Right?
Yeah.
Zekin, okay. Probably,
Zekin,
right?
Probably at the at least judging by how they played recently. Yeah, probably Zekin.
Okay. But again, they're a teamwork-oriented team, so for me, it's hard to... It's not like Optic. It's not like some of the other teams. Where they have somebody who's just
carried. Right.
So much better, right? They have a player who's just so good that it's jaw-dropping, and they can win entire almost maps, it feels like, by themselves. Okay. For Xset, there is some hope that, teamwork makes the dream work, right? And we've seen that in the past in Valorant, that teams that have good coordination, good play, can get it done. But we've also seen that individual play can win too. So, you never know what you're going to run into.
The problem is this, right? It's like, basically, if anyone follows the NBA, I think it's a similar sport in that regard. It's like, the theory of the sport is teamwork. It's about have a team and have everyone do their role. And we'd all love to believe that the team who wins the NBA every year is just the one that played the best basketball and moved to the open man and all that. But the problem is, I always say this, the best team wins the series, but the best player can win you a game. And that's the difference. If you actually have like the best basketball player, you can be the second best in the series. He might just win you the last game seven or something. So the problem I have with this team here is essentially, that's why I asked the question that way, is I believe like you can sometimes have the right meta, the right opponent, maybe get the right bracket. Maybe everything works and it is like a movie and you just have like the feel good story that we did the right tactical play and we played off each other. But the problem is at the end of the day, there's a reason why, like I said, whenever someone wins the tournament, we usually take their best player and say, is he the best in the world? Because the superstar players, and especially in TAC FPS games, can have enormous impact, obviously, as the aforementioned names have. So that's one thing also I'd have a question for this team. Even if they end up being the best, do they have the player who can sort of like just take over the game, It's a question.
It's sort of the... go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, to be, I suppose it's a... I don't know, maybe a little bit nebulous, but like the whole argument of best player in the world, unless you are literally talking about like the mechanical roles, like I think is almost a redundant conversation anyway, because you performing as the best player is also going to be dependent on your teammate, like who you're with. Because like you could take fucking simple and put him in the wrong team and he could be us, right? Or like, you know, perform us or never even get to a position where he is even in that conversation because the team aren't going anywhere, yes. Right? And it's just you know, I think it is a bit of a superficial conversation in a sense, and it's not one that's ever going to go away, you know. It's not a morally wrong conversation, and it's not one that will ever be culturally eradicated as a discussion, but like it is just a little bit strange as well, because we've been saying like maybe this could be the chance for Dirker to cement himself as best player in the world, but like Dirker on the wrong team, you may never have heard of him, right? So it's just sort of like I don't know. It's a strange one, which is why I think that like, okay, who provided the value in that series is, or maybe like over the course of a stage, I think that's always like a good conversation to have. So obviously like in the context of this, like who on Xset would be that person, like over the course of this tournament, perfectly like decent conversation, but I don't think like you could turn around and be like, oh yeah, that person's the best player in the world because they were on the team that won.
No, fair enough. Yeah, I will say as well, I actually think even the way you frame it is quite useful. Like, if you talk about who essentially popped off or played the best in this last period of time, what you're probably inferring is who they play around and how they think about the team themselves. I will say there, though, like, apparently it's a good job she's like a very open-minded person, willing to listen to different views on talk shows, right, here, paper thing, because sounds like Gio would be fucking terrified if she was a tyrant. What would she even talk about the way she framed it? She was like, it's not morally wrong and must be like culturally eradicated. Like, what the fuck? What? I was never even thinking those terms. Okay. I was going to say
it's player just, skill is morally wrong. I'm like,
I was just thinking, fucking hell, I would go to 11 on this one. Okay.
I totally understood what you meant.
No, I did as well. I did as well. Yes, I did as well. Sorry. It was just very evocative the way you said it. Exactly. Tell you what, I bet you run that fucking Twitch chat like a fucking tyrant, right? You just block them all, do you? Get out, eradicate them all, get them out of my fucking Twitch chat. All the reply guys, get them all out.
Oh my God.
Oh, by the way, along those lines, I thought this would be funny to randomly mention. I did see that in the wake of you doing that video where it was like, you know, why Sentinels fell off or why Optic kept going or whatever, right? I already knew you were fucked because you've already picked a topic that even in the title implies Sentinels aren't good. So you're already done. Like you were toast before I even saw the comments. But because of that, I knew I had to go into those Reddit threads and see the comments. And it was all just like the classic reply guys, like, oh yeah, you think you are a fan of Sentinels? Name every map they ever played. It was like that meme, wasn't it? Like, because it was all just people like, well, technically, I mean, Sentinels did actually like win like in season one. Like, it was all just people trying to reply guy you the whole time, wasn't it?
I kind of tried to avoid Reddit. I didn't post it on Reddit.
Oh, so, fair enough. Like, okay. I probably shouldn't be relating then. I actually just brought the negative comments to you.
I don't care. Like, but okay. I knew that it probably would be posted, and I knew that there probably would be people who were pissed off. And I got some people in the YouTube comments who were like, kind of pissed off, and some people who, I don't know, people just made like really simplifications. The really funny thing for me was after Masters, so I took the piss out of Sentinels quite a bit on the desk, but I had like, there was like a bunch of people who were saying to me like, whenever I said things like really good things about Optic and Cloud9, who are the two teams that I really like came to be a big fan of in NA, people were like, I thought you were a really big fan of Sentinels. Why aren't you supporting Sentinels? I was like, I've never said I'm a big fan of Sentinels. Okay. And then another half of people being like, you know, you just can't stop it. Any excuse to shit on Sentinels. It's like, can you, you guys need to have a conversation?
Exactly.
Like,
yes. That is still low key. That is also low key though, like a hint that you're doing a good job, is that essentially they can't actually guess which team you like. They're just getting it wrong. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, you can't just always be like, I heckin' love 10's bat chest. You know, like, actually, like people need to understand, like, sometimes you gotta shit on your favorite teams. Like, I shit on DRX all the time. Sure. Like, I've gotten in trouble here in Korea because I was blasting DRX last year for only using Phantoms. I'm like, guys, like, the Phantom isn't always the best gun in every situation. Like, the Vandal is probably better in most maps and most agents and most players' hands because of the one-shot head tap potential at any range. I mean, and yeah, there is a little bit of bullet drift on the Vandal past 30 to 35 meters, but fuck, I gotta criticize this because all Phantoms wasn't the answer. They were losing duels because they had different guns.
By the way, as a random aside, because you might find this funny and a lot of people in Valorant won't know it, but when DDK did the CSGO major at the end of last year, so it was in like sort of, I'm going to say like October, November or something in Sweden. Obviously, he was from Valorant at the time. He wasn't actually in CSGO. Like he'd fully switched over to Valorant. He was working, right at the beginning, paper thin. I think even on the first match, he just randomly called the Deagle the Sheriff. He just said that like in like map one or something. And we were all just sat there like, Dan, get... come back, you idiot. Like, because remember, all the CSGO fans are going to be like, he's left the game, he's a traitor. Like, right in his opening game. And I was like, bloody hell, fucking hell.
Dude, I feel it. I cast PUBG.
That's so painful.
And there's a sawed-off shotgun in PUBG, right? And I called it the shorty at the last event. I was like, ah, fuck, it's called the sawed-off in this game. Like, I feel him. I did the same thing.
The one that really fucked me up was, like, when I first came to Valorant, you know, I was still... essentially full-time classing Rainbow Six. And in Rainbow Six, the characters are called operators. And then in Valorant,
operator
is a gun and the characters are called agents. And I remember, like, I must have slipped up at least once, right? But, like, I can't remember any specifically egregious examples. But I do remember at the beginning, I would have to, like, actively give brain space to thinking about it while casting just to be like... okay, the operator has Rainbow Six. It's only a couple of milliseconds, but it felt like an eternity in my head. Yes. And I was like, oh my God, these video games are out to get me.
The worst one for me, sadly, was when I did some content mistakenly in Dota. And obviously Dota and League of Legends call them different things. It's champions in League of Legends. It's heroes in Dota. And all you need to know is if you say the other one, it's the end of the world. Like, oh my God, you said champions. Like, it's the same shit, isn't it? Just little fucking guys, you move around on the screen. Anyway. Right, I've got a couple more teams we can ask about here. So one team I want to ask about is definitely GO, Guild Esports that you just referenced earlier, because they're obviously another team. Actually, funnily enough, in Europe, they were sort of in the exit position. They were always in the mix. Like, when they would get to the playoffs, you're like, maybe they could do it, and then they just wouldn't do it at the end, and they would just come back fourth or something, you know, and you'd be like, next time. Right, obviously, this time they've made it, and they're another team where we had Barbar on a past episode, Paper Thin, and it was implied from listening to other players who came on that this was a team that people thought was good, like scrim practice and stuff, and they were like a quality team. People again thought like maybe they can be in this position. How good are they actually going to be, do you think, GO? Do you think like obviously they've got a couple of players that have some legit experience? Like, can this be actually like a sort of a surprise team, an outside team that could do something?
I don't think Guild will make it out of groups.
They are in a hard group, to be fair. They are in a very stacked group.
They are in a stacked group. Yes. And I think the other three teams in that group are too good. Guild, I'm really happy that they finally qualified for an event. I think they've sort of at that point where you almost want to say like they deserve it. You know, they've been putting up like results that just haven't quite been good enough for a long time, but they've been improving. They've made roster changes over, they actually only made roster changes at the beginning of this year. They stuck and committed to their previous roster for quite a long time before deciding to change. Bringing in Coldamenta was, pretty big. I'm pretty sure he's IGLing them. He was previously on G2, and his sort of experience has been really valuable, I think, to the team. A lot of the issues that I have with Guild are that, if you're kind of like looking at which players to look for in this team, I would say that Leo and Trex. Leo is a fantastic player, as is Trex, but my concern about them, and specifically looking at Trex, is that while he is a really, really good player, I don't think he's consistent enough to perform on an international stage where he needs to be. And I think that they are a team who will probably come away from this having learned a lot, and I think it'll be really valuable. And you get your teams like that, right, who come in, they have their experience, their first, you know, international LAN experience, they go away, they continue to improve. You might see them like two LANs in the future and they'll do better, right? And I just think that's where Guild are at in their life cycle. I would be amazed if they made it out of groups, and I think that'd be an insane story, but I really, really don't see it happening.
Yeah, what they have going for them, and I really like you pointed out, you know, Coldamenta, his veteran experience as an IGL. Leo, this is an initiator meta, at least in my opinion right now. It feels like initiators have a lot of impact on the game, particularly with Fade. And, you know, Leo can be really, really good on Sova or Fade, you know, arguably one of the best Sovas. He's one of the best Sovas in the world with Saucy and very few others that I would even consider in that category. So, I mean, I think they have that going for them in terms of there is some precedence. I think the real problem is the group they're in. I mean, think about the battle-tested teams that are in that fucking group. Optic, yeah. Loud, and Crew. Are you shitting me? That's insane. You've got teams that have made top threes of major events, teams that have won major events. I mean, that sucks for your first event to have to go into that. That's tough, man. And if they make it out, I'm going to be so fucking impressed. I really hope they do, just in that sense, like to really kind of, you know, show that they're there to play and that, you know, even against these other great teams, you know, they're ready. So if they can get out of groups, I will say this, if they get out of groups, I think they're poised for a deep run. I think they're a team that you got to be scared of if they get out of that group.
Yeah. I mean, it is like you have the two finalists from the last event and then Crew, who are the only team in the whole world who have been to all five LAN events.
Yep.
So good luck.
And I never know what to expect out of Crew. Sometimes I think they're going to be terrible and then they shock me. And then other times I think they're going to be good and they're not. I have no idea what to expect from them.
It seems like
upset
fodder. Yeah, they can just spoil the tournament for one team every time. What about this then? In light of what you said there, Pipathin, if you think it's like an initiator meta, let's use that model for a second. How does that imply which other teams, like, for example, some of the other squads that we haven't talked about, which ones should that factor make potentially more interesting, or maybe they have an outside chance to do something? Who do you look at in the rest of the field on the initiator angle that like, you're interested in?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously for me, DRX, but North Epsilon has to be up there for me right now. Jojo is another Korean player. He used to play on a team called Go and Go Prince last year in Korea, has moved over to North Epsilon this year to join Meteor, who is a really talented duelist. And he's had really good success with the Fade. I think a lot of Korean players are comfortable on Fade because it plays somewhat similar to Breach in some ways, so there's sort of that level of comfort where you want to get to that alt, you can use that Nightfall to make these combo pushes that teams are really, really comfortable with. And North Epsilon as well has the benefit of having huge LAN experience with a huge crowd, right? Like you saw at the Saitama Arena, there were tens of thousands of people there. So I will say that I think I'm kind of interested in that. I think Fnatic can benefit from this just because of the way that I've seen them practice and I understand how they practice and talking and listening to Boaster. I think he can utilize the initiator set plays really, really well. Yeah, I'd say those three teams, right, for me have a lot of potential, at least here. Xersha, potentially as well. I mean, Scary, you know, and the other players are really, really good on that team. So, yeah, I'd say those are the ones that, you know, maybe you're not necessarily thinking about other than Fnatic as teams that could get it done here.
Sure. By the way, that's even so surreal to me that that's where they had the venue for the VCT, the Japanese one, if people don't know, because that venue is where they used to have all the legendary like MMA events in Pride and stuff, where they had like enormous crowds, like massive like WWE style entrances with the pyros and stuff. Like that's like a massive sports stadium in Japan.
It blew me away that crowd was so big, because like this is the thing about Japan, right? It's like a couple of years ago, if you'd have asked me or anyone, I guess, like they would have said, okay, like Japanese esports, you think of like, you know, the fighting game community.
Games. Yeah, exactly.
You don't really think outside of that. And then Rainbow Six in 2019 had one of their majors in Tokoname in Japan. And that was massive. Like the Japanese fan base there was insane. And I remember being really taken aback because I was like, since when did the Japanese like first person shooters? And then again, now in Valorant, right? It's so big. And it just sort of makes you think like, yeah, I feel like Japan isn't just like the FGC place anymore. Like this is like really getting quite big there.
It's because basically the basic thing, as far as I know, maybe Pipfin's going to comment on this. Basically, it's because until a couple of years ago, there were like some weird like legal restrictions that Japanese esports had, where like effectively, as far as I know, it was something weird. Like you weren't allowed to be like a pro player or something. Like they weren't allowed to put normal prize money in tournaments or something. You had to like win like a prize, like an actual like a PC or something. Some weird thing like that. I was sort of told that's why basically the culture was only fighting games, because it was sort of you're just in the arcade then, aren't you? And it's like an amateur thing. So I was sort of told that like essentially they were sort of artificially suppressed, unfortunately, from having esports developed, because obviously people wondered. You look at Korea especially, remember Korea to us is relevant because of esports. Aside from that, it's a tiny little country, like it's not the major power in that region, so people always wondered why wasn't it like Korea. So were you going to comment on some of that, Pip? Did you have some
idea? Yeah, no, you led into that perfectly, dude. So it used to be considered gambling, right? So right. Esports was considered gambling, right? So right. like you think about, I don't know if you guys know how pachinko works, right? So if you go to a pachinko room, you play this stupid game where there's really loud metal balls and flashing lights and shit everywhere, and you want to try to accumulate as many metal balls as possible because you can't accumulate money. So what you have to do is you take those metal balls, like the big basket full of them, you can't turn it in for money directly. You have to go to essentially what's a convenience store across the street or sometimes attached to these pachinko rooms. And you turn it in and you get, like, you know, ramen or other daily right. household items, like literally like mops and fucking right. like okay. dish cleaner and stuff. What? Like, okay. so you can get this
so
kind of stuff.
Like
I'm not
a
even
currency.
Kidding.
Well, it's basically so like in the fair where you get the tickets, but instead of spending it on like a teddy bear, you're actually using it to buy some like, real thing you want in real life.
Yeah.
Wait, because what's so wild about that? Like, that means that surely the value of those metal balls must drop based on what like currencies and stock markets and shit like that
Maybe.
Are doing, surely, right? Because it's got to be against the yen, right?
In theory.
That's nuts.
If the balls, yeah.
I don't know what the conversion rate okay. to little metal balls to the yen is. But
anyway, the basic, yeah, the basic gist of it is, though, like I say, as far as I can tell, they, like essentially, societally, they repressed esports. So actually,
yes.
I would imagine in a bunch of different games, if enough people care about the game to bring it back to this point, there's a real chance for Japan to suddenly become relevant. As well, by the way, Valorant is the first game they're doing it in. Like, look at it. Because if people don't know, in League of Legends, they had a little breakout where a team did all right. But like, that's Zeta Division, that was like an enormous result last Masters, which is an angle I want to ask about, because the one downside is this. That's one of the only storylines we don't get to pick up and take through again, because Zeta didn't make it, which is sad, because Gio, on all the past episodes, was like, the best thing about this team is like the story that they stuck together, and they made it back then. It's like, they didn't make it this time, but okay.
Oops.
Like, fair enough, okay.
A lot of people are really sad about it, though.
Well, here's the question, because what I want to say is this. Look, on the one hand, yes, congrats to the team that beat them. Let's see how they do. But the other reason why is if we tie it to some of the narratives you were talking about before, this other team is fresh. They're coming to their first one. People won't have the same expectations. Again, the expectations on your first one is like, you know, do what you can to swim, but we know you're probably going to fail at some point and we don't expect you to win the event. I think people would have been really hyped if the Zeta Division team had come. Like, people were sort of ready. Yeah. People would have said maybe they can win the event, right?
No doubt. No doubt they can. And I mean, I think they gained a lot of confidence from that event, and not just them, but also Japan as a whole for esports. I mean, it was the biggest moment in Japanese esports history, just period in a story. I don't think there's been anything that will top that for a little while with that Zeta run. And there's so much I want to talk about with this team, not just Zeta, but also Northeption and Japanese esports in general. I want to go back to something real quick, talking about how I knew that Japanese esports was going to change, when it was going to evolve. So back when I was casting PUBG much more frequently back in like 2019, pre-COVID era, I went to Japan just as like kind of like a vacation. And since it's so close to Korea, it's like a 2-hour flight, right? And do you guys know Shaka? He's a really famous FPS streamer in Japan. He's really popular there. Averages like 20,000 viewers on Twitch. Just absolutely insane. So I met him and I was talking to him and he's like, yeah, man, like there's like merchandise of mine in the big like electronic marts. And he's like, and there's like cardboard cutouts of me and all this other stuff. So I went to Japan and he's all over the place. And him and other like esports professionals from like teams like Detonator and Detonation Gaming, like they have branded merchandise. This is back in 2019, mind you. This isn't like now. This is like 3 years ago. Branded merchandise, mice, keyboard, cardboard cutouts in convenience stores.
Yeah.
In the combinis. Right. Well, Korea, I've actually been trying to preach this, that Korea needs to start doing this. They kind of did it with Faker, with like, they had like ice cream cones that had his face on it and shit. But so the start of this all snowballs into where we are now with this whole, now esports is starting to be accepted. Now Valorant is the biggest esport in Japan by a mile.
Oh, okay.
And so they're starting to figure it out. And so Northception, a team that sort of last year was playing really well, they were one map away from making it to Champions last year in the LCQ. They lost to Full Sense in a best of 5-3-2. And so they dropped some of their players. Like they had Soldom, right? The original Korean Jet, quote unquote. And so they bring in a couple more Korean players. But the big change they made this phase was they brought in Bale, a Korean coach who used to play for We Made Fox with Termi and all these other guys. And this guy fucking knows his shit. And he's from TNL previously in Korea, who was a team that basically only lost to Vision Strikers. They were the second best team in Korea most of the time, not always, when some of the teams like F4Q and New Turn started making their runs. But they're always really good. So he comes over and he's got North Eption playing like a well-oiled machine. And so now, you know, Zeta, their coach has an Overwatch background, right? He wasn't a tactical shooter coach. Okay. So I think coaching here makes such a big difference. I mean, there's some great players, of course. Dari Ali's nuts on that North Eption team as well. But there is the coaching, like the way they play, the organization is really, really good. And, you know, they were able to adapt incredibly well. And that has to me, go to the coaching staff that North Eption brought in, because they lost to Zeta previously before the grand finals, went to the grand finals and really well handled them.
Sure. By the way, as a detail, as an aside, if people do look, I know there's some League of Legends, and I saw it's the same in Valorant. Another reason why Japan, especially if all these societal aspects have been lifted, will get more and more relevant is because they're also able to use Korean players, because not only like logistically, yep, they're so close, but also this is like a detail about Koreans that people in certain esports games don't know. I know this from StarCraft, which is that in Korea, whenever they play a game heavily, there will be too many players. Like, there's obviously way more like supply of people who want to be a top pro than there is demand for top pro, because they can only be, like in Korea, there's usually like, say, like 10 big orgs or something. You know, there's not going to be, they're not going to be 50 orgs no matter how big the scene is. So what happens is the people who are like the tier 3, tier 4 pros, they just go to other regions. Like literally in League of Legends, you'd have some guy in like some obscure like fucking a Vietnam team or something would be Korean, like what the hell, or a guy on like a Brazilian team would be important, because again, they're just gambling, like maybe it's the good Korean that we don't know about or whatever. So Japan has loads of them, so I would imagine the same thing as well. It's not even that they need all the Japanese players to be amazing to tomorrow. They're going to have a bunch of Koreans as well. And this is how you know also Koreans do have an amazing work ethic. Because when they go to these teams in China or Japan, they don't speak Japanese or Chinese. And the worst thing is these teams might not even have functional English. So they're for real, just like, I don't even know how they do it. They just figure out some sort of middle ground where they just have simple call-outs or something. Or you hope, because obviously, like, look, you can tell the person start learning Chinese. Mate, you could come back fucking 10 years later. You could, that's one of the most complicated languages in the world. Like, if people don't know, the joke is Japanese, Korean and Chinese are three of the hardest languages to learn in the world. And there's almost, yep, fuck all overlap. Like there's some Chinese characters in Korean, but that ain't going to help you speak Chinese. Like there's no overlap. So God bless these players that they're willing to go play in another region away from your home, not your super famous region. And then you play in another language. Like these guys have an amazing work ethic. So I just think of some of the complaints the NA players have. It's like, motherfucker, I'd like you to try that. You go and I'm going to take you and drop you in some fucking country. In this case, have to be like the Middle East or something, and then you have to speak like whatever Persian language it is. Go on, there you go, off you go, have a nice time. Meanwhile, they're all complaining now, like, oh, fucking, oh, what time's the game? 3, not 4. Like, they have the most whack complaints ever, don't they? I know.
I will say, Korean and Japanese are almost identical grammatically. It's just, yes, like the vocabulary is different. So it's probably, yep, not too hard to find a middle ground between Korean and Japanese. But as for Chinese, grammatically, that is a whole other beast. So,
It is. Sure. I've heard from the Korean players who have gone to Japan to play that the biggest struggle for them is, yeah, just brute force learning vocabulary. Like, yeah, you know, there are some words that actually transfer over because, right, you know, way long time ago, Japan and Korea did have some conflict. Course, there was some, yes, invading of one country and another. So there are a few words that do transfer over. But for the most part, you're absolutely right. They're completely different. And it is like, I actually learned a little bit of Japanese. I studied a little bit, just kind of took like night classes because I was traveling to Japan. And then I came to Korea. And now I've been studying Korean pretty extensively. And there was some help there with what Gio was just talking about, the grammatic. Mm-hmm. Grammatic structure is almost identical, so there is an initial boost, but still, the words are still going to be,
yeah,
grossly different. The way you pronounce them is so different. It's a very, both languages are so different. Like Japanese, for example, is very consonant heavy. Almost every word has consonant vowel. Like there's, yep, some words that are like double vowels and things like that. Whereas Korean has, I think it's like 14 consonants and like 16 vowels. So Korean is extremely vowel-y. Like, you're, like you talk a lot kind of with your mouth. Yeah.
The way, as opposed to talking with another part of your body, the way that you that you spell in the two languages is like really why that is. Because in Korean, it's like you spell essentially the individual letters. It's different to how we do it in like in the Roman thing. But yeah, you spell with each individual letter. But in Japanese, you don't, which is why it's so consonant heavy. But yeah, I do like it. It is an interesting one because it's like the skeleton of the language is the same, but it's all the flesh on top of it is like totally different.
Yeah, Yeah, that's totally correct.
Oh, by the way, one last topic I wanted to hit was the other team that we haven't mentioned, but there's an obvious reason, is obviously FPX. And the problem is, because as of the recording of this show, it's actually the last information I saw implied they won't have their full lineup, unfortunately. So obviously everyone knows they qualified for the previous Masters, but just couldn't go as a team, and Team Liquid written their spot. This time around, it's like, it sounds like they get an angel there, that's fine, but it sounds like Sagetsu is basically the player that won't be able to attend potentially. No one knows yet. Again, maybe by the time this comes out, it all turns out. He just implied, like, he hasn't updated it, but he said himself on Twitter two days ago or something. This is a few days ago, though, but he said, like, I can't wait to watch this event online. So obviously the problem with the FPX one is they might never send their real lineup and this might all be moot. But I got the vibe, if for some reason, doesn't seem like it's going to happen, they could have sent the real team. I get the vibe, actually, we'd already have been talking about them as a team that could win the event, right? Wouldn't they have been one of the teams in the mix? A lot of people, every European guest I ever talk to, this is one of the teams that they always behind the scenes think is mega. They think this team's like one of the best in the world. What do you think, Pipithin?
Yeah, no. If they had their full roster going into Masters 1, they would have been my favorite to win it. I don't see much difference. I mean, top to bottom, this roster is incredibly talented. Like you were saying earlier, they play well kind of on the fly. They play well off each other. I just, it's hard to, like, talk about this team because I'm so uncertain of what they're going to be able to get there with. But if they have the full roster, I think they should be considered one of the favorites. I think you got to put them right up there with Fnatic, in my opinion, then.
By the way, if people don't know, Angel is a super veteran of Counter-Strike, as in, like, he would have been playing, like, listen, he would have been tier two at the time, but he would have been playing in like the mid 2000s in like CS 1.6 in Ukraine somewhere with some team. So like, this is a guy where like, I don't think he was an IGL the whole time. I think he was an IGL mainly in CSGO, but his experience level is incredibly vast. Like, this is one of those guys where, you know, there'll be people at this line, like
born in the 80s,
like maybe the Alfaya guy. This might be, remember, because of the online shit, this might even be the Alfaya guy's first ever LAN. I'm just going to go ahead and say right now, unironically, Angel will have played something like 500 LANs in his career, like
before
some outrageous number. Yeah, exactly. Like, just some out, and yeah, in theory, before he was born. Yeah,
but he was born in 2005.
There you go. That might have been when Angel was first playing his first lands. Exactly. He was taking his first steps. He was playing his first lands. Now they both battle each other, potentially, assuming they face each other.
I was already in university.
I was born in 1996, so I was reaching the end of my first decade in 2005.
I was in middle school.
Happy medium. I'm interesting because I still feel like, especially amongst like esports talent and stuff, I feel like I'm still kind of a baby. I'm still quite young. But then like, by the standards of esports pros, I'm in like the boomer category, which is very like, it, you know, you get some real like mixed identity stuff with
yeah, if people don't know, what's weird is it seems like the average broadcast talent is about 5 or 10 years older than the average pro if you look. Like, most of them are like late 20s or like early 30s actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I still feel like I'm quite young, and although there is sort of like a new generation coming through at the moment, which means that there are quite a few who are younger than me now. But like, when people are like, "Oh, you turned 22 in esports," and then suddenly like you're too old to do anything, and I'm like, I am way too young to be made to feel old. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I was born in the wrong decade for that.
Here's how I know I'm like super old. I didn't start casting esports like professionally until I was 32. I was like, I was an absolute fucking boomer already.
Okay.
I mean, I had played in, you know, some other games and stuff, like in Halo and some other things. Like, I tried to compete. I would go to MLG lands and stuff and do terrible. But like, I took a break for a while, and now it's like I see all these kids around me, and I'm just like, what did I get myself into? Did I choose correctly here? But I don't know. It's kind of fun too, like seeing the younger people, and like, you know, like here in Korea, like Stax is pretty, you know, pretty young, and he's a guy that speaks decent English. So I talk to him a lot, and just to see him kind of grow up and learn, and you know, like that kind of thing. It's also really inspiring. Like, it's really fun to see, you know, these kids, you know, really kind of chase their dreams and, you know, shoot for the moon and kind of be along for the ride. I don't know. It's super fun.
This episode was kindly supported by Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Kyle R., Travis Goff, Adam Oakes, Animosity, Bot Pounder 420, Hades, Jensen Gore, Joseph Ginsberg, Kovacevic, Pacey, Tobias Bernasconi, Tosh, Toucan, Zumba, Zyrathenia, and as always, special thanks goes out to my boy Jerky's Minion. Want to suggest a topic or a guest? Would you like to ask a question in one of those AMAs I do? Maybe you want to find out who the upcoming guests are for my interviews, or you'd like to be part of one of those long discussions with yours truly. Well, if any of these perks appeal to you or others, check out the description box link below to Patreon and put your money where your mouth is and join the Skrilluminati today.